Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Not About the Weather. This is episode 22, where we'll be hyping and griping about all of our favorite pop culture and non-pop culture related things. I am Brittany, and I am joined by Natalie and Adiana. A little bit of a shorter panel this week, so how's everybody doing?
Good.
I'm good.
Natalie's hot. Yeah. We've been hearing about it.
Sorry, it's very humid and hot here. I'm good.
Good.
I'm here and I'm good.
When does your fall usually start, Natalie?
Well, technically on the 1st of March, like on the calendar, but it can be, and it sort of starts kicking in around mid-March, April. Global warming has made things very unpredictable in the last few, years. And I don't know how to even think about our summers anymore because they're so different to how they used to be. But yeah, March, April, and then May. And then May, you could have a day that is like 30 degrees Celsius, which is like, 85 or 90. And then it could be all the way down to like 10 degrees Celsius, which is, cold and, under 50 or something. So it really fluctuates and it's only getting worse. We're directly under the hole in the ozone layer in Australia, which is something I noticed when I went to Hawaii in November, that like the heat, the temperature can be the same, but the sun burns worse and causes more damage to both human skin and the environment because of the hole in the ozone layer. So we're all going to die, basically.
Well, that's a great way to kick this off. So if you have any interest in talking about how we're all going to die because of the hole in the ozone layer, you can contact us at NATW Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. You can reach out to us on our website at notaboutheweatherpodcast.com. Is that the actual thing?
What? Not about the weather podcast.
Because then right below it, it says natwpodcast.com. Oh, also yep. Exists.
Yep, natwpodcast.com is just a splash page
gosh. You are so on top of it, Natalie.
Yeah, you are, because I was on the latter website today, and it's beautiful, and I was like, wow, this is so great. But and then I read that other thing, and I'm like, oh, there's two.
That's the thing that you can just give to people to be like, this is the umbrella of podcasts that we do, and
we should make more podcasts that have that same acronym.
Yeah, nothing about this works. I am still fighting for it. I'm gonna get that podcast made.
That'll just be like an all hate, like, and then yeah. So or it could be like about the it could be like about myth busting or something, like it could be about
I'm gonna make it happen because I am still so proud of that name and I'm really mad it didn't happen.
we can do that. Okay, we can do that. That's fine, go ahead. So any other NATWP acronyms, or NATW podcast acronyms to go on our splash page collection of podcasts.
All right, I'll start brainstorming after this, but since we're on Not About the Weather, we are going to move into the format that we have established, which is a hype and a gripe. So we're going to talk about an obsession to share and a grievance to air. And since my topic covers both of them, I'm going to go last, and we're going to kick it off with hypes today because I want to get really hyped and then just cut my own dreams down because that's how I like to roll. So let's start with Natalie because I am always up to talk about Hugh Grant, which is your hype this week.
It is. I don't know. And it's funny that you said that you're talking about him right before I came on online, but I just really like Hugh Grant, you guys. You may or may not have seen the weird amount of people all across the internet, many revered tastemakers, other filmmakers and entertainers and writers that I'm, you know, all these kind of people that I really like, Edgar Wright, Kumail Nanjiani, all sorts of people, everyone determined that children's holiday film Paddington 2 is the best film that they've ever seen. It is also currently the highest rated film on Rotten Tomatoes of, like, currently, like, without any bad ratings to bring it down. And I was like, surely not. Surely this, either this is like a meme I'm not getting, or it's the most charming film of all time. And I did watch Paddington 1 and Paddington 2, and they are very cute. But, you know, the humour is very cute. They're very pretty, and it's all very, very sweet, especially for a live-action CGI film, which is not my favourite thing in the world. Super, super, super cute. But Hugh Grant is the villain of the second Paddington movie, and he has received a BAFTA nomination for this role.
What?
And it is... Yep. And it is deserved. I really cannot fault Paddington 2 as a movie, and it has made me... It has everything. It has a scene where Paddington turns the entire prison environment he's in into an episode of The Great British Bake Off. It has a car chase, except without... It's not cars, it's steam trains. It has... It really has all sorts... it has Joanna Lumley being hysterical. It has everyone in Britain who's cool wants to be in Paddington, apparently. But anyway, Hugh Grant is the villain of this movie. Nicole Kidman was the villain of the first movie, and she was not as good as Hugh Grant. And he's so funny in it. He basically plays an actor who is a failed actor who is so egocentric that he won't work with anyone else. So he's been trying to get this one-man show made for ages, and he does all of these, he basically has all of these like costumes from all the roles he's played, and he kind of talks to himself as all of the characters he's played, like he has conversations with them and then back to him, and it's all very ridiculous. But he's just so good, both in this movie and in general. Because over the course of my life, many of my favourite movies have been Hugh Grant romantic comedies. And I've just been thinking about that over the past week and how interesting that I find his performances compared to, you know, a lot of other actors. Notting Hill is a huge favourite of mine, and I've watched it relatively recently, and I was thinking about how interesting the role he plays in that is as a commentary on kind of like celebrity culture, in the way that he kind of engages with this celebrity woman compared to the way the rest of the world around her is treating her. And Bridget Jones is really, 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 really brilliant and funny, especially because he'd built this reputation as like the dopey nice guy and then turned around as this kind of sex pest villain in that movie. But I just love his performances in everything, and I don't know why, because it's very blustering, and you know, like the, he has that very, very, you know, posh tone and that kind of stoppy starty delivery. But I don't know, for all that he, you know, kind of is a super posh famous actor, he feels like one of the most natural character actors that I've ever seen. And I don't know why he never made it big, or, you know, bigger than he is, and if he should have. And I don't know if that was because of the scandal that he had in getting arrested with a prostitute, right? You know, right when he was like the, you know, trying to cross over into Hollywood, which in retrospect is not that big a deal, honestly. Like, you know, I don't think he was abusing her or anything. They just got caught when prostitution was
I'm sure she
illegal.
Was making very good money. I'm sure he
yeah
barely.
It's just, I don't know, I just really, you know, like, I just in retrospect really, really like him. I find him really really funny, really natural. And I just think he should be in everything. And I just find it just both completely ridiculous and wonderful that in this year of our Lord 2018, Hugh Grant has got a BAFTA nomination for Paddington 2. I just think it is so brilliant. And just, I'm just, it's just bringing me a lot of joy at the moment. So, yeah. I don't know. Any Hugh Grant feelings in particular?
Well, I have a question, Natalie, because I'm a little confused by you saying he never made it big, because I feel like he's very big. I mean, I feel like he's big in the way Julia Roberts is big, in that she had her moment in the 90s where she was like the biggest star. And since then, you know, now she just does movies like here and there. I feel like he was very big. He was in a movie with Julia Roberts, and like he's co-starred with Drew Barrymore, and he's
the lead often
and with big people.
Yeah, I know. It's just interesting because a lot of what he's big in is stuff that is British productions. He's been like a British transplant in a few American movies. But it's more that the stuff he's been successful for has not been Hollywood productions. They've been British productions that have happened to be successful in America. Not everything, but most of the things. And so, maybe he was really big at the time. So he would have been, you know, his big moment in all of those kind of movies would have been when I was, a young teen, so I wouldn't have had that much perspective on that. But I think he's in so many, working title films, like, you know, Canal films, like all of those British sort of European production companies. I don't know, he's never been a Hollywood guy. I don't know. I think he probably is big. I don't know. Would you say he or Colin Firth is more famous in Hollywood?
Honestly, in my opinion, they're like level, except Colin maybe has a little bit more esteem than Hugh.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I watched like 2 weeks' notice, like on loop when I was younger. Like, it's yeah. one of like my top five favorite movies.
It is a good movie. I'm trying to remember, I also remember loving Mickey Blue Eyes, which I don't know in retrospect whether it was racist or not. It may have been. I remember finding that very, very funny. But I'm just like looking at his film career, and yeah, like stuff like Bridget Jones, Notting Hill, and stuff like that is all British.
He was the lead of Love Actually. I feel like whenever they have a British movie, they're like, "Oh, Hugh Grant should be the lead."
A lot of those movies.
We'll put Colin Firth in there too.
Well, because a lot of those movies are produced by the same company. They're all Richard Curtis movies under Working Title Productions, and they are that's the thing. He's like. He's a go-to actor for a certain type of movie and a certain type of writer, but not really much outside that range. But anyway, I very much appreciate what he does, what he does put out into the world. And I just find him really, really funny. And I just find the BAFTA thing for Paddington 2 just fantastic. Especially because it's, we're seeing more and more nominations at the moment for roles and movies that aren't necessarily what we've come to think of as like award bait. Like the pool really narrowed to only a certain type of movie being like look addable for the performances or the writing or direction. Whereas this year we are branching that back out again, and you look back at Oscar nominations of the past, and children's movies and fantasy movies and all sorts of things used to get nominated all the time in the main categories, and it's really narrowed down to only like gritty certain type of movie, and that has maybe started blowing back out again to actually widen that view. And Hugh Grant getting a BAFTA for Paddington 2 is, in my opinion, one of those moments. So, yeah, I do recommend seeing Paddington 2 and Paddington 1 for context. But yeah, I definitely think it is worth it. And it's just so, yeah, so funny to see it like that.
Well, I was going to go yesterday and it was sold out. It's been out for weeks here and it was sold out and I couldn't go and it was miserable. So I cleaned my room instead.
It's just really cute. It's just really cute. He's great. You know, the other people in it are great. The bear is surprisingly endearing, and it's just, I don't know. It's just yeah. He's okay. Let me tell you who he's up against on this. He's best actor in a supporting role. He's up against, William Dafoe in Florida Project, Woody Harrelson in Three Billboards, Christopher Plummer in All the Money in the World, and Sam Rockwell in Three Billboards, and Hugh Grant in Paddington 2. That's the BAFTA situation, and I just think it's so funny and fantastic. So,
I have a genuine question that is going to make me sound ignorant. Do the BAFTAs only reward British actors?
No. So the BAFTAs are the British, it's the British Academy of Film and Television. So it's basically the voting of,
like the British Oscars.
Yeah. So it's basically like, yes. So it's from the British, association or whatever. Like, you know, I don't know if every Oscar voter is American. Like, if you can only be is the Academy, like the American Academy of Arts and Motion Picture or whatever, or you know, and in the same way, the Golden Globes are the Hollywood Foreign Press. Like, it's a certain voting pool. The BAFTAs are worldwide productions being voted on by the British pool of, the people in the artistic pool in Britain. So we have that in Australia as well. We have the AFI something. No one cares about winning what Australia thinks of your movies. So I don't even remember the name of it. But yes, it's not only British actors or productions, just the voters are British. Anyway, moving on from Hugh Grant. Paddington 2, the hype is real, apparently.
Have you guys seen Music and Lyrics?
I have the page up on my computer because I was like, you know what? I really like Music and Lyrics, but I have a feeling no one's bringing it up and maybe it's not Hugh Grant and I'm confused.
No,
it's I never saw it.
You have to see it. Okay. Oh my gosh.
Because I'm not even a Hugh Grant fan, but once I saw that movie, I was like, I get it.
2 weeks notice, though. So great.
2 weeks notice is good. What else is good that he's in? Lots of things are good. Obviously, people know Love Actually, Notting Hill, About a Boy, if you're a Nick Hornby fan. He's good. Yeah, he's not quite as acclaimed as some others, but it's good. I shall get on the Music and Lyrics train if possible. So yeah,
you should. So Ariana, do you have something you want to hype besides your hot chocolate that you made before recording?
Yes, it's delicious. So I'm just gonna go for the easy route because I couldn't think of anything. So I'm going to say that my hype for this week is One Day at a Time season 2.
Yes!
Out Friday, January 26th worldwide, and everyone should go watch it. It's really amazing, and you should go all the way to the end of the credits because, as Brittany pointed out, my name is there, and it's really cool and exciting. So, yeah.
So how many people work on a show that don't get in the credits? Like, how high up do you have to be to get credited?
Well, I was looking at the credits and I was like, wow, there is really not a lot of names here. I'm sure there are dozens of people that are not on there.
Mm-hmm.
Dozens, if not 100. Like, there's a lot of people who work on a show. So I really don't know why we are there, because we're just PAs. We're just assistants. The only thing, I mean, this is really, I feel like, a matter of privilege, in that because we're the direct assistants of, like, the big wigs that interact with us every day, that's probably why they feel like they should put our names there. But yeah, there's a lot of people whose names aren't on there. Like, I was looking, nobody in construction. Like, I feel like not even all of the hair and makeup people are there. Like, craft services isn't there. There's a lot of people. So that should be my gripe.
I only just realized that the mother, like the lead character, is also on Jane the Virgin.
Yes, she is.
I did not make that association until I watched, caught up on Jane the Virgin, and then went back to One Day at a Time, and I was like, oh, right, yeah. So that's cool. And yeah, I'm excited to watch it. And it's cool that we got to see some of it, and that you get to have your name there for all of your hard work translating things.
I should probably pitch it for people who have no idea what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
One Day at a Time is a sitcom. It's a reboot of the Norman Lear sitcom from the 70s. And Norman Lear is very much involved in this one as well. Norman Lear is the guy who made, like, All in the Family. That's probably the most famous one. And a lot of, like, The Jeffersons, a lot of other socially relevant sitcoms. And that's kind of what his sitcoms were known for, is for being not just hilarious, but also socially relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And this one is One Day at a Time. The reboot is very much the same. It's about a Cuban family living in Los Angeles, and it deals with a lot of, it's really funny and kind of corny sometimes, but it also deals with like the issues that the family goes through, including, I mean, I don't want to, it's not really a spoiler, but like a girl developing like her sexuality or exploring her sexuality, and issues of like racism and things like that. So there's a lot of interesting layers to everything. And Rita Moreno stars as the grandma, and she is by far the most hilarious, coolest person on the planet. So
she like doesn't even have to say anything, and I am just captivated by her. She's so great in every episode.
So good. And if you watch her live, she's just like, I feel like so beyond everyone else. Like you said, Natalie, like she can just be like standing there making a face, and I'm like, this is the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life. You're so funny.
And it's taped live as well.
It is taped live. So
is that, how common is that these days?
Well, it's about as common as sitcoms are. So sitcoms have kind of got like a bad rap right now, which is a real bummer, because they're so cheap to make and their hours are so much better for people who work on shows. And also they're just so fun. It's really cool that there's like a product at the end of every week that you get to show an audience. So you get like that audience feedback immediately, which is really neat. But most sitcoms are taped in front of a live audience. So, I mean, How I Met Your Mother wasn't, but most sitcoms are, like Friends, Will and Grace, they're all taped in front of a live audience. So when reviewers are like, oh, the canned laughter, like somebody, one of the reviewers was like, oh yeah, One Day at a Time is really good, even though they have that canned laughter. And I was like, excuse me, that's not canned laughter. That's my ugly laugh, okay? Those are all real laughs from real people.
Yeah, someone said that, a critic said that at the beginning, after the first episode of Will and Grace, and every single episode of Will and Grace following the premiere has one of the cast members saying, Will and Grace is taped in front of a live studio audience. It's like obnoxious and annoying to hear every week, but I'm like, they're just making a point and rubbing it in.
Do you mean like at the end of while the credits are rolling?
No, like as the first scene is coming up. Like, they don't say it over the people talking, but like it always Will and Grace always opens with like a shot of an exterior, either like of Will Grace's office building or the apartment. Yeah. And it says it then after in the beginning of every episode.
And I feel like you can tell that it's taped in front of a live studio audience because every now and then, like, the studio audience will think something is like hilarious and the actor has to like stand there.
Yeah.
And, like, wait for their moment to pass. And that wouldn't happen if the show was being like, if the laughs are being put in because mm-hmm. it doesn't flow as well.
Yeah. It's funny because, like, what would you consider a sitcom versus a comedy? Like, what would you, like, Modern Family, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, stuff like that is not so,
no.
live studio audience.
No. Yeah. A sitcom is shot with its three cameras or multi-cams, literally yeah. a multi-camera.
Yeah, yeah.
Something like Modern Family is called single cam, and that means that they just shoot with one camera at a time. And mm-hmm. so multi-cams are sitcoms, and they're usually shot in front of a live studio audience. They're also much more like plays, like they take place on a set. They don't usually, like, go outside into, like, nature. Not necessarily, like, nature, but, like, you know, like Modern Family shoots at the same school that Teen Wolf uses, or, like, real yeah. places for, well, this is all on a set.
Yeah, see, that's how I would have defined a sitcom as well, in terms of the multi-camera and single camera and theatrical aspects. But that is not what the internet thinks sitcoms are anymore. They just call all comedy where antics happen a sitcom, and I do not think that is correct. So, yeah, it's just, yeah, just curious. But, yes, it's very fun. And you and do we know if there's going to be more than two seasons, or is that not something they do that quickly?
We don't know yet. Last year they got picked up for a third season literally a week before they started working on the
oh
second
my
season.
God.
So like they're like, you're picked up, you start work next week. So that was like in March.
I don't know how to live like that. Like how like people are like, you know, yeah, waiting, you know, just waiting around to like.
Well, that's the thing. They're not even.
What if they need to?
What
if they need to book something else? Yeah, like it's.
Yeah, it sucks. But right now, everyone is kind of like working as if anticipating that it's coming back. So hopefully, it does. Because it really sucks when you're like expecting it to and then it doesn't.
Well, it's gotten nothing but favorable reviews from what I can see. So I hope it comes back because I thought it was great. I watched it all this weekend.
Oh, what was your favorite episode, Brittany? Using vague language.
Using vague language. You see, there are little bits in every episode that like make my favorite moment, but I really, really think it's actually the second episode. Is it the second episode? Schneider spinning is probably my favorite thing that I've seen him do ever, where he becomes a spin instructor.
I totally forgot that happened. I've only seen the end. I've only seen sporadic episodes.
Oh, it's like, I think it's the second or third episode. I don't know why. I watched it twice. I thought it was so funny. I love what the mom goes through in that episode. She's like trying to study for a test.
Oh yeah, that's the second episode. Yeah. That was supposed to be the opening episode. But then they switched it to the first episode was supposed to be the second episode. That's how we shot it.
I did like the first episode too.
But I think at first I was like confused, but I do think that the first episode, if you're going to go, like, for an introduction for, like, somebody who's never watched it before, mm-hmm. or for critics, that's probably, like, a better episode to be like, please pick us up again, Netflix.
Yeah. Please keep watching. It's good. but it's so good. I loved all of it. I love, like, the whole, there's just so many layers to the show. There's, like, because everyone is, like, whether it's immigration or, you know, trying to go back to school, or you know, there's the sexuality stuff that you touched on, and even just like having that like dumb idiot next door who is Schneider, like coming in and like just saying all the wrong things at the wrong time. It's so great. I love it so much. And then she's a veteran. So like there's that whole thing. Like last season, there was that episode where she's trying to just get a doctor's appointment and it was like impossible. And I like that whole episode was so great because it's literally just her on the phone the entire episode and it was so well done. Oh, it's really good, guys. Go watch it if you haven't watched it. I love it. Is there anything else you want to hype while you're on here?
I don't think so. Everything Brittany said. Go watch it so I can keep my job. Thanks.
Yes, watch it so Ariana can keep her job. And you can see her name in the credits again and be like, hey, I know that girl from that thing.
Also, fun fact that no one else will know except you, listener, is that there is a nurse in episode 8. His name's Ariana. And only they never say her name out loud. But if you go to the credits, it says playing Ariana is, I think her name was Pat or something, but she was nice.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah.
Named after Ariana. See, you've made it.
Named after me. I really have it now.
It wasn't the podcast that got you there. So that's, you know, the podcast can only take you so far.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. I don't know if I'm ready. I know I called for this episode to happen for one very particular reason, and I'm not ready to talk about it, even though I've been talking about it forever. So I started a show literally, it's only been 9 days, guys.
Since you started the first season.
Yeah, 9 days ago.
Oh, and my God.
I would like to personally shout out to Brooke, who has been my Sherpa through this whole journey, and she's not on this episode, but man, she, if I was not texting someone, I would probably would have lost it and been deeper down the rabbit hole than I already am. So yes, thank you, Brooke, for first of all pushing me over the edge to watch this show, even though Natalie did a great job of pitching it the first time we talked about this show on this podcast.
Yeah, I definitely made Brooke watch it.
Yeah.
It's like a cycle.
Yeah, and then Brooke was watching it and tweeting about it, and then I was like, okay, here we go. So, the show, in case you haven't already guessed, if you don't follow me on social media, is Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, and I haven't had a show completely take me by surprise in a very long time where I just feel so deeply connected to every single character for the entire 40 minutes of an episode and beyond, like where I finish an episode and I sit there and I'm like, I want to watch that again. I don't even want to watch the next episode. I want to rewatch what I just watched 100 times. And I'm getting close to that number, and it's only been 9 days. So I don't know why this show has come into my life at the perfect moment, but I think it just has. I've been so exhausted by television lately. Like, unless it's a show that I already know that I like and it's coming back, every new show has just been, I can't get into to most things anymore, and like shows that are entering like their fourth or fifth season, I'm just sort of like, okay, like here we go again. Like I fell off of Once Upon a Time this year, even though I probably should have fell off of it 4 years ago. American Gods has put me through the freaking ringer, which I'll talk a little bit about in my gripe because it relates back to Dirk. And you know, it's just I felt like I could never feel connected to a show again, and it's been really frustrating. And then here's Dirk and Samuel Barnett and Elijah Wood and everyone else who's in the show. Every single character, minor characters, are just so good and perfect and wholesome. And I did tweet this, but I have been I hate this like phrase. I just hate it. This cinnamon roll thing that the internet loves to do, like where things are so precious and whatever. I was like, this is the stupidest thing ever. And then season 2 of Dirk Gently, Dirk gets taken into Blackwing and I'm like, hold on. I get it. I get everything about wanting to protect someone who is just so innocent and pure and perfect and being harmed, and I would like probably take a bullet for this character if even even in a war that he probably caused, I would do it. I would do it, and there would be no questions asked. I'd be like, yes, I'm coming to fight for you, even though this is your fault.
Oh. I think cinnamon roll is an interesting phenomena because the internet had gone on for a long time without having like a kind of catch-all term for a character that was like pure without being annoying, like without being a wooby victim kind of thing. Like, and so cinnamon roll is just an interesting like lightning in a bottle meme that people decided to latch onto and use, and I find it very convenient. I find cinnamon roll in terms of describing a character very, very convenient. Yeah, it's just such a weird turn of events.
I think I just didn't have a character to apply it to in my own life, because the characters that I'm drawn to mostly are very brooding and angry and can probably take care of themselves. So like Angelus and any one of the Sherlocks that I love, they're all like, they can all do everything on their own. I was never like a Watson sympathizer who's like kind of precious, but I was like, no, I like Sherlock better. Like even in elementary, like Johnny Lee Miller, he's totally fine. He doesn't need anyone to really take care of him. He would be okay. Dirk would not be okay. And his face, Samuel Barnett,
I don't understand how he can do it. I don't get it. It's so like, I want to watch the History Boys again so badly, but I feel like I just can't go there yet because
like History Boys, clearly, as Nat and I have probably talked about, maybe even on this podcast, one of my all-time favorite movies. But I can't go back yet. Like, I'm not ready to go back to the History Boys. I just need Dirk in my life a little bit more. And he plays him with such conviction and just, he really, I don't know how him and Elijah Wood aren't starring in everything together.
It's pretty phenomenal. And the big thing about Dirk was I was at the first Comic-Con panel for Dirk before it started because I was like, oh my God, Sam is on a panel at Comic-Con. This is just nuts.
Whatever it's for, I'll go.
You know, and the showrunner, Max Landis, who is a crazy man, and he's a terrible
human.
Yeah.
We're getting there.
That's why very the transition is going into the
great. Anyway, but the point is, he said this thing about Sam, which was very, very true in that, apparently, like, they had a hard time casting Dirk. They had a hard time actually finding a Dirk that worked because everyone who came in and read for it played it cocky. And Sam was the first and only person that came in and that they looked at and they were like, oh, you get what we're trying to do. You get that he's, like, miserable, like, and no one else was getting that apparently from the sides that they put out, you know, like for the auditions or whatever, and Sam was the only person that came in and gave it that layer of depth. People were going like too comedic and too cocky, and so yeah, it is interesting, and it does, I think, with all of the characters address a lot of, it's just a lot of stuff in the script, a lot of expression of emotions, feelings, and mental states that is not really the done thing to talk about. I don't mean it's like groundbreaking mental health, except it also kind of is, in that it's, you see a lot of characters, nearly every character, you know, talking about themselves or talking about the world or reacting in ways that we don't usually see people react on television, especially not in just any run of the mill thing that's not like a big issues situation. And then it's just a lot, you know, they react, you know, for all that Brittany's saying that, you know, there's purity to it, there is, but there's also impurity to it in people reacting in ways that hit hard because they're so true, but that other shows don't really write that way because they kind of don't because it's a bit too realistic in some circumstances, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and it also benefits from it feeling realer, I think, because of the heightened situations that they're in. So, like, they're traveling through time, they're swapping souls, they're fighting in a land called Wendemore with, like, people with pink hair versus an evil mage that a child dreamt up. Like, you know, like, it's very heightened, and these people are, like, you know, projects in the CIA, and there's so much going on all the time that these, it amazes me that these grounded moments can come out at the way that they do. Like, there are just scenes where it's only the scenes that are, like, the best and that I really love between any of the characters literally are probably no more than 30 seconds long. And it's a reaction, or it's someone saying one thing. Or, like, there's a moment in both seasons where, like, Dirk is talking Todd into, like, you know, just sticking around. But then in the second season, it's Todd talking Dirk into just sticking around. It's like, but they're talking each other. Todd even says, like, in the later episodes of season two, he's just like, I'm sick of talking you into your own bullshit. It's like, you brought me into this, like, craziness, and I'm not fighting it. And yet you're, like, rejecting your own, like, circumstances in life. And it's just, it felt so real and true for both characters. Like, I got Todd and I got Dirk, and I wasn't mad at either of them for doing what they were doing. In fact, I felt like both, like, good for you, Todd, and also, like, gutted for Dirk. So it creates this, like, world where you're feeling for so many characters, so many different things all at the same time.
Yeah. It's very messy and honest and weird. Like, the characters are written, every single human in the world, not on this show, every single human in the world is weirder than we publicly acknowledge humans to be. Every single person is weirder than they look. And this show is honest about that. And I really love that. And I love the writing and everything that is packed into it. Like, with these performances, they really have such a great thing going there. So yeah, obviously there's some other aspects of it that have problems in a variety of ways, which, as Brittany has made this her hype and her gripe, that she'll probably get into it. But as an insular piece of work that exists, it's so brilliant and yeah, very. I did an interview with one of the guys who's in it, who's also on Supernatural, not too long ago. And he was like, and we were talking about the fact that it's not for everyone, and that's okay. It's for the people that will, like, find this because they're, you know, they're of a certain mental state or a certain subculture or whatever, and that they'll find it and it'll be what they need and love. But it's not exactly trying to be something that everyone loves. And that we, you know, wish there was more room in the world for, you know, for projects to go ahead and be made without the primary aim being, you know, pleasing the masses, that it doesn't have to cater to everyone, if you know what I mean. And I think that this is a you know, a good example of that. But obviously that's not necessarily something everyone agrees with, for a variety of reasons, but it definitely works for me, and it probably wouldn't without these specific performances from Sam and Elijah and a lot of the other characters as well. But given that I already knew them as actors, like, to see them do this work, like, it's the best work either of them have ever done, ever, and it's so, oh, it's just so good. But yeah.
It's brilliant, and I love it so much. But, you know, it has a huge problem in that as I was watching it, I obviously knew that it already was canceled, and so getting to the end of season two was particularly traumatic, because not only was it over, it probably isn't coming back. And then, you know, there's the whole, this is going into a gripe now, so we're moving into the gripe. So my gripe is a combination of finding something you love and wanting to fight for it to continue, but then also dealing with the fact that you don't want it to continue if it means that it is being continued with its showrunner. Because I watched this in a bubble knowing that Max Landis created it, but also just because everyone I knew who watched it and loved it for the reasons that I was hoping to go into it and love it because of. So there's Max Landis, who is highly problematic in a very many ways, including anything that comes out of his mouth in public. And also he was just charged with sexual assault. And also he just has this reputation of being paid a lot of money for very bad movies, like really bad movies. So, and he's very much, and he's very loud about how great he is, which is also so freaking annoying. I just don't like him at all.
Sorry, go on.
No, I just have a question, and because see, I wanted to watch the show, and then I found out that it was by Max Landis, and I looked and I saw that he wrote almost every episode of season one. And I personally don't feel like I could watch that without thinking of him. Or if I saw, if I was like, oh, what a great line, I would be like, ew, but he wrote it and he's a terrible person.
I mean, I don't really know what to tell you about that, because there are certainly tons and tons of other projects that I, you know, would feel the same way about. The world of Dirk Gently was not created by Max Landis. Obviously, it's an adaptation of a Douglas Adams Douglas Adams series of books, Douglas Adams character, new stories about, you know, adaptation of a universe that already existed. But yes, he wrote, he is not actually the showrunner. He's not the day-to-day showrunner on site, if you know what I mean. So he's not the person managing the production, but he is the person who writes, because he is. Max Landis, in my experience, is a deeply mentally unstable person who has the ability to just create huge volumes of work, and some of it is very, very, very good, and some of it is very, very bad. But he is like crazy manic, fast, like churns out, you know, 100 pages of writing a day, kind of like he's just very fast in you know, in all of the good and bad ways that can affect a writer. The second season did have episodes written by other people, and they could clearly become familiar enough with what was important about the universe to replicate what made Dirk like to replicate, you know, the truth of the characters. So that's also a good thing. But yeah, Max Landis is certainly someone who people viciously hate, and who has had a huge history of controversy with all sorts of things. I look at him and find it very difficult to understand how he's gotten away with the stuff that he's done, but also find it very stressful, because a lot of the reactions that I've seen him have to things are things that I know that I would be like if I was in his position. Not sexual assault. That was a new and fun development, which is obviously swaying that needle down to the irredeemable. But a lot of his behavior, just interacting on the internet and acting like a fan, was kind of a willful, to me, like a willful ignorance of his position of power. That he was just saying stuff because it was what he felt, and he didn't want to be held accountable. He wanted to be held accountable for it in the way that any other fan of stuff would be held accountable, as opposed to a person in a position of power saying something that was like, you know, having any weight on others. And that kind of like willful deniability is definitely like something I would also get angry about if I was in that position and I just wanted to keep acting the way I'd always acted and not like, you know, and try and make that other people's problem. So I found that aspect of him very sympathetic for a while. And some other stuff about him that came out was a lot more black and white than his general manic behavior. So I don't know. I think the work that he's done here is very good. The work that he's done elsewhere is fucking terrible. They have managed to get a writing team that has the soul of it in there. And the fact that I know people who've worked on the show, a lot of people who worked on Supernatural as well, like, you know, love the environment of the set, would give me hope that it could continue in a positive manner. What's going on with him specifically is he seems to have vanished from the internet. Like, people, you know, made those accusations about him sexually harassing, you know, women he was pursuing, and then he just vanished. And so I don't know, maybe he's gone from the internet now. So the question is, if the question is whether I think Dirt could continue without him, I think it probably could, given the second season writers, but I think that the first season has value regardless of him. But that being said, I'm speaking as someone who before recently did have a lot of sympathy for his behavior, and that coming from people who I know who have met him and worked with him as well as just my observation of his behavior. And kind of, I hate being misinterpreted for stuff that I've said, and I've seen him go through that like multiple times with stuff, but I don't know how innocent that was. Like, I don't know if I'm projecting.
Are you referring to the Ray stuff?
No, I don't know anything about that. I'm referring,
Natalie, though, but you and here are very different. And here, I cannot fathom you comparing yourself to this disgusting man.
Before the sexual assault thing, like, he is exactly what I would be like in that position.
No, Natalie, because he does not act this way. He acts this way because he can, because nobody has ever, everyone has let him this entire life. His father is incredibly powerful, which is why he's lasted so long despite such terrible, mediocre work, for the most part. And he's treated women terribly. Like, everybody who knows him in real life knows, like, he's admitted, like, on the Howard Stern show and stuff to, like, harassing women. So when these accounts of actual assault and rape came out, nobody was surprised, because this has been his behavior. So he acts like this because he can, not because he doesn't know any better. Like,
like, as I said, I'm completely willing and able to believe that. Like, I'm completely willing and able to believe and shift the perspective of what his behavior meant. But before that, and as I said, my first experience with him was coming into this show. I've since known a lot of people who have, like, met him on the circuit or worked with him via Supernatural, because they also shoot in Vancouver. And basically my, like, as I said, I'm totally willing, like, my perspective is totally shifted. But I did not take his behavior just in day-to-day erraticness as particularly problematic until this happened. And so it is a shifting of perspective of basically obliviousness to, malicious intent, which, you know, is a difficult thing for me, because I have dealt with, on a much smaller scale, so many people assigning malicious intent to my behavior when I know that it wasn't. So yeah, I had a lot of empathy for that, which has obviously shifted in a massive way now. But yeah, no, I do feel, you know, very upset about it.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, like, where you watch something and you love it so much, and then you never really, like, I want to talk about Dirk all the time, but I'm like, I'm going to get obliterated by people for talking about Dirk. So
I still see a lot of people talking about it, yeah, without any association.
And it's, but it just sucks because, like, you almost feel guilty for loving something, and I should, because I shouldn't be supporting this person. And it sucks because I love everyone else who is involved in it, but the very large, large piece of the puzzle is ruining Sam and Elijah and every single, the directors who, oh my God, I don't know how they created those cuts and found those moments so well. It's just, it's frustrating because, and also, like, it's probably not going to continue because it has the Max Landis name on it. And yeah, yes, it could go on without him. That's, I'm not concerned about its ability to survive without him, but it's done. I think it's done.
It all happened at the wrong moment, yeah.
Because it happened in the first place. Like, it was able to get off the ground in the first place, and then it did well. Well, well-ish. And it's just not going to come back, which is why it's also my gripe, because you have to love something in a bubble a little bit and also acknowledge how horrible it is that it got made in the first place, which is problematic.
Could this be a situation, though, where, like, since it was already an existing property, like for example, Supergirl and The Flash, all of those already existing properties, and then Andrew Kreisberg, who's also a disgusting person, you know, he was exposed, and they just, like, they fired him. They brought in, like, new showrunners. Is that a possibility for this show?
I think it's definitely comparable. In terms of watching it and appreciating the work, yes, I think you can look at it in the same perspective. I think it is one person out of the hundreds of people that make a television production possible who, yes, there's a lot of lauding about his, you know, his genius, and it's certainly an idea that wouldn't have got off the ground with someone else pitching it, if you know what I mean, like with someone else who wasn't as determined and sort of powerful as him pitching it. But at the end of the day, where you are now two seasons later is a project of hundreds of people who happen to get where they are because one guy is really good at selling himself, but all of them, you know, have contributed, you know, equal or more to his worth in order to make a show that is brilliant. And the same could be said from Supergirl and The Flash and stuff like that. So I think the work can be viewed with the appreciation of everyone aside from him, and it doesn't, you know, belong to him. It, you know, the only thing that I'm grateful to him for is that he was apparently confident enough to start putting that kind of stuff, like that kind of open weirdness, as I mentioned, into dialogue that, you know, other people apparently aren't allowed to do, but now the precedent is set and he did it and other writers continue to do it. Whether it will continue getting made, the BBC America dropped it, basically. So the production company still wants it to exist. The other producer is called Arvind something. I can't remember his last name. He's another massive piece of the puzzle, and I hope he's not problematic because he is basically the curator of all things Douglas Adams. So the actual producer is this guy who has made several Douglas Adams adaptations. He's made a play of Dirk Gently. You know, he does the comic books and stuff like that. So he is actually the holder of Dirk Gently, and he is heavily involved with the show and loves this interpretation. And so maybe he would be the factor that was able to you know, to continue it now that it's off the ground. Yeah. But
that's like my other part of my gripe, which goes into American Gods, is like, this is another show that I have to worry about this with. You know what I mean? It's like, can any show that I like keep it together? Like, American Gods has been, I have zero interest in following anything that's going on with that show now. Like, production wise.
What is the deal with American Gods? Like, why did they
rent them? Mess. Like, no one knows. In a short summation, no one is on the same page. Stars is not on the same page as Brian and Michael, who are not on the same page as Neil, who is not, like, no one is talking to one another, which is problematic because messages are getting misinterpreted by literally everyone.
Yeah, they think that it's going to season two is going to continue. You know, the Stars guy up front is like, oh yeah, Neil Gaiman's going to be show running it. Neil's like, I'm definitely not going to be show running it. I'm going to be doing the same thing I was doing with Brian and Michael, which is to, you know, work with the showrunner on
bringing it to life. He doesn't have time to. Show running is a full-time job.
He's also like he's been on Good Omens.
He's been talking for months about how much he freaking hates it on Good Omens. Like he's doing it because he needs to do it, but he's like, yeah, this is my idea of hell. So yeah, that's not a thing. Michael is saying that Stars fired them in random subtweets.
Yeah,
there's been no official announcement of Brian and Michael leaving Stars. All just people commenting on like leaked information to Deadline. And Brian Fuller's like, yeah, I'm going to go run Vampire Chronicles.
Yeah.
I love fan fiction and Anne Rice sues people for it. That's going to go super well. So,
like,
yeah,
Brian, I feel like, is on a personal, like, rampage against me. Like, I feel like he's just trying to take everything he can from me. Like, set me up for failure. We had Hannibal and then Star Trek and now American Gods. I'm like, I can't deal with another Brian Fuller project. I just don't want to.
And it's just, this is a whole other story.
My question is, why would they fire Brian Fuller? I thought it was, like, wasn't it a very successful first season?
Yes, it was. The party line is, or when I say the party line, I say the nonsense that was leaked to like Deadline from like someone in the mail room who was like clearly looking to make drama. Because it was like this leak happened before the deal was done, basically. So basically it like forced the hand. But the rumor is that they didn't think they could produce their vision of season two without bigger budget than Stars was willing to give them. The budget had already been increased from season one, so the budget was already increased, but it apparently was not increased enough for their liking. And I am sure there's more to it than that, because that is just a bizarre circumstance. I don't know, you know, what they wanted, if that is true, but the budget for season one was already pretty massive. They had really great effects and stuff, and I don't think that the effects are the most important part regardless, but yeah, budget was increased, it still wasn't enough, they didn't want it, the guys didn't want it, but that would imply that the guys said no and left. I don't understand why they'd be fired. Like, it's very,
yeah,
there's no truth going around. Like, it's just, it's
a mess, and it's giving me a headache, and I never want to write another news piece about American Gods as long as I live.
Maybe they'll get a really good showrunner. Maybe they'll get, like, Jeremy Slater or something.
Yeah,
like,
well, then the other wrinkle here is, like, Gillian Anderson's like, yeah, no, peace, not coming back as media. And I'm like, okay,
but
great, set you up.
Is she just quitting television? I don't understand.
She wants to work on other projects, but, like, leaving the X-Files makes sense to me because she's been playing the same person for 15 years and here she's like, I'm just leaving.
Luckily, media is the one character that can be recast. Yeah. But
also, she can just like play a much smaller role too.
Yeah. She, you know, if they want to continue with her, they could like cycle in whoever they want like to do imitations. But anyway, I don't know. It's all very strange. It's really disheartening. there's like everyone's like weirdly subtweeting each other. Like, did you see like Pablo Shriver being like, why won't you come back and write for me, like, to respond to,
yeah,
like Michael Green? And I'm just like, why are you doing this in front of my eyes? I don't understand. Like, it's so...
And it was like, if Stars didn't fire us, we would have hired this person. And I'm like, oh my gosh, stop it.
It's so weird.
It's so annoying. And now I just have another show to watch go through it. So great.
I don't think that Dirk will necessarily continue.
Yeah, I don't think it. I'm putting all of my eggs in the canceled basket. I think it's just going to be better for me that way.
And I think that it certainly exists as something to watch in a bubble, and appreciate, for the work that it is from everyone involved, and not really continue to promote it in future. I genuinely do think it is worth watching. It's just a really unfortunate situation on a number of reasons.
Anyway. Let's complain about some other things. Who wants to complain next?
I'll go next.
All right. Because
I didn't have anything, but you're complaining about petty showrunners reminded me of Joss Whedon, and I'm so angry at him right now. And that's it. That's my gripe.
You're angry at him about the past, or has he done something new?
No, I'm angry about him at the past, specifically season 4 of Angel.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. What is going on?
It's really... You know, it's better to have pancaked and lost than never pancaked at all. But it's rough. I don't
understand why someone would ruin their own show for the sake of their ego. Like, it's just the pettiest, stupidest thing I've ever heard. And it's just dumb. That's it. That's my gripe.
How's the Wolfram and Hart building?
Oh, it's still under construction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it takes a while to close all the portals to hell, you know?
They haven't taken down that fencing.
Nope, they have not. There's still, like, trucks and stuff working through it.
Well, look, season 5 of Angel is an interesting ride. It certainly has an original twist to it, but it doesn't really make up for the fact of the downfall of season 4. It certainly ticks up, mainly because Joss Whedon was removed. He went off to to focus on other things, so they kind of just let Angel run, you know, under the other producers, and it definitely ticks up, but a lot of damage was done in season 4, and there's not a lot of coming back from some of it.
I can't wait until this season is over so I can like fully complain without spoilers.
it's really not a good time, is it? So
I mean, okay, it's a great time for an Angelus fan, but
oh my god,
it is not a great time for any other reason.
Can you imagine how I feel so cheated, like, that we don't get to see Angelus interact with the real Cordelia.
Yep.
Like, it's so frustrating.
Yeah, there could be Angelus is so great, and David Boreanaz, I feel like it just would have been so much better if everyone was the way they should be and not the way they are right now.
And imagine, like, how great he is with Faith, who he talked to, like, one time.
I know.
We could be having that with Cordelia. This is just such a mess.
It is a mess, and we still have so long to go.
Yes.
No more no more shows where it's, like, a combined total of this many seasons. I can't.
No.
I can't do it.
It's been pretty intense.
This is like 12 seasons altogether, isn't it?
It's been pretty. Yes, it is 12 seasons, 12 full length. Well, 11 and a half full length seasons. Ugh. Yep. It's going to be okay.
Just shot himself in the foot is all. Just like it gets so good and then it gets so drastically bad. Like, well, powering through. Nat, do you want to talk about our dear friends / frenemies over here?
So my gripe is about the Oscars, and it is about Pasek and Paul getting nominated for the second year in a row for Best Original Song for the Oscar. And this is a very complicated situation for me because I really like Pasek and Paul. That's not actually against them. But if you've cast your mind back to 1 year ago when they snatched the Oscar out of Lin-Manuel Miranda's hands.
Oh, I will never forgive them.
For freaking La La Land, which does not deserve any credit at all.
Somebody sing me that song. How does that song go?
If they win it this year for This Is Me from The Greatest Showman, they'll win two Oscars in a row, which will have needlessly ripped Lin-Manuel Miranda's EGOT away from him because they would just get another one the next year. This Is Me is by far a better song than what they won for last year, which I don't remember the name of because La La Land is like watered down. I couldn't sing you
the tune.
I saw The Greatest Showman, by the way. I griped about this on a previous episode. It was like very strange, but I saw it. Some of the music was good. This song is by far the best. And, you know, they're going to perform it at the Oscars with Kiala Settle and, you know, all the cast, and that'll be good. So I wouldn't be that mad if they won for this. But if they win 2 years in a row, which means they get their freaking Oscar, because they're now one away from an EGOT as well. They need an Emmy. They got a Grammy tonight. They have three, and Lin has three. Lin could have got his last year, and then they would have had their Oscar this year instead, and that would have been fine. And I'm so furious that if they win it, I'm going to be so pissed that they won last year that I'm just going to be dying. Like, I'm just going to be so freaking angry. So I really don't want them to win because it'll just cause me too much rage. I would instead like to win Sufjan Stevens for Call Me By Your Name. I haven't seen Coco, but Robert Lopez is already an EGOT, so he's okay. Like, you know, he doesn't need that. I mean, you know, it's always nice to have another award, I suppose, but he's already an EGOT. So I would like Sufjan Stevens to win an Oscar because he's a freaking weirdo and it would just be hilarious. And it is quite a good song. But if Pasek and Paul win it again, just going to be so mad about last year that it's just going to come crashing down on my head all over again, and I just don't know what to do with myself. So that's my main Oscar beef this year, aside from, you know, a few other things. They did okay this year, the Oscars, but the song, I need them not to win, even though it is better than what they already won for. So yes.
Yeah, I mean, I like them, but I agree. La La Land, I just don't get it. Everyone loves it so much. I hated it so much. I did not like it at all. I was so annoyed by just everything. All the performances annoyed me. Everything annoyed me about it. And everyone who I thought would hate it loved it. Like my family, who does not like musicals, they were all like, La La Land is so great. Like every time I go downstairs and it's on, my parents are watching it and I'm like, what are you doing? Why? My dad is convinced that there's going to be a sequel. I'm like, that's not how this works. He also asked me when the sequel to Silver Linings Playbook was coming out. So, I mean, he's obsessed with sequels.
That was not
sequels.
A good movie. That he was a miserable movie.
He loved it, and he's like, well, when in the second really? One? I'm like, Dad, there's not going to be a second one.
I couldn't even finish it.
That's so weird. And freaking La La Land, Pasek and Paul didn't even write the music. They only wrote the lyrics. So if they had just given it to Lin last year, then if they'd just given that one to Lynn, then they could have won for this year where they wrote the music and the lyrics and it's a better song with a better meaning and better performers. So I'm just so not okay.
Wait, they won just for the lyrics of that stupid song?
Yeah, so I assume the music writer as well won, got a prize, but yes, so that they were only the lyricists for that one. The music was done by someone else, whereas the This Is Me from Greatest Showman, they did music and lyrics. So music I lyrics.
Hugh Grant, just stick with that.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. That's me. That's what I'm annoyed about today. So
this is you.
Yeah.
One day we're going to come on here and I'm going to gripe about This Is Us, which I believe is the worst show on television.
Oh, no, really?
You're wrong. And I will fight you on this.
Oh my God. I've never seen so it. Bad.
No.
Maybe you guys should both sell me on your opinions and I'll decide whether to watch it or not.
Well, I can't, I guess I can't sell it because I don't watch it because it's so bad.
Okay.
But
I can't, you have to watch the first, so the first episode has a twist at the end. So I don't want to spoil it.
But I know the premise of the show.
Oh, what's the premise then? But the don't spoil it for our listeners.
The premise of the show is that it is flashbacks from a family who from the parents as young people to the kids as adults, and it is about a family who had triplets. One died in utero or at birth, and so they adopt another baby instead, born on the same day. And by the time we get to the future, the dad is dead, so we don't know how he died, and that will be a part of the show.
Yeah, and it's so good. I literally cry every episode, so Brittany has no heart.
God, no, it's like, this is the saddest family in America, apparently, because every Entertainment Weekly headline after each episode is like, and in a devastating twist, and I'm like, shut up! Like, how? Calm down. It's like, I cried my eyes out. Why?
I don't cry. I don't think it's because they're sad. I always cry at, like, the weirdest moments. Like, in season, usually I cry for when Beth comes on because she's so, like, strong. And then something will happen and I'll be like, oh, my God, Beth. Like, whenever, like, when she got that stupid postcard at the end, post-mortem, I was like, oh, this is so, I'm just so moved by it. Like, by how much they love each other and how good that they're like such an idealized family. Like nobody's parents are that perfect or wonderful.
And the young mom is Mandy Moore, right?
Yeah. It's Mandy Moore and Milo Ventimiglia.
Yeah. I love Mandy Moore as an actress. So yeah, that's,
she's really warm and delightful. Mm. And Sterling Brown is like, he's such a good actor. He could sell me like, lean cuisine and make it exciting.
Well, I don't know. I've never seen any of it, but yes, I know it's a thing. So yes.
I can't. It'll be like Game of Thrones. I'll watch it in like 20 years and get into it then. When I have a family and a soul. Because right now I don't have a soul, apparently.
Wow.
Everyone I say I hate the show too, they're like, you are out of your mind. And I'm like, well, I can't get into it. I just, there's no reason for me to sit down every week and be traumatized by, you know.
I don't think it's traumatizing. I find it so uplifting.
Ugh. Well, I've blocked This Is Us on Twitter. Like I've muted it because I like the headlines make me so angry. I just get so irrationally angry about it.
You go to a lot more lengths than I do to like avoid things. I don't think I've ever blocked anything on Twitter.
Well, I mean, like, if it's not in my life, then it doesn't bother me.
I've never cried because something is sad. I only cry because I'm like so moved by the beauty of the world.
That's nice.
I can't get into it.
I cried watching The Post yesterday. So I was like, the First Amendment is so beautiful.
Everyone, so many people said they cried all through the last 15 minutes of Call Me By Your Name. And I really liked Call Me By Your Name, but I did not cry.
I I almost cried, and I was getting there, but then this woman in the row in front of me, like, let out this huge sob, and I started laughing.
Oh my God.
And then I was like, oh, I'm a terrible person for laughing at her, but it was just so loud bizarre. In a quiet theater.
I loved it, but I didn't cry. Anyway.
Oh, anyway. So those are our...
Where are we?
Yeah, those are our hypes and gripes for... This week, I can't wait to see how many people are going to flood in to tell me I'm wrong, but, you know.
About This Is Us.
Yep, you know, part of living. Brittany's wrong about the most popular thing on television. So another segment that we like to do on this podcast, not about the weather, not nothing about this works, which we will not be doing this on, is two truths and a lie. So since I am hosting, I guess I will be doing the two truths and a lie. So I am, I've been in a Groundhog Day slump after seeing the show 7 times and it closed. So speaking of things that are, you fall in love with really quickly and build yourself up to, and then they are taken away from you brutally.
Side note, did you see the article, the Australian Guardian article with Tim that I posted on Twitter this morning?
No, I didn't.
Oh, it's freaking depressing. But anyway,
well,
so
I'll read that after this. I'll read that after this. Looking forward to it. So this week I'm having a little bit of a Groundhog Day resurgence and I'm really pumped about it. So I decided to do Two Truths and a Lie, Groundhog Day edition. My two truths and a lie are, I have never seen the movie Groundhog Day straight through. I have met Andy Caro, who plays Phil Connors in the musical, 3 times. And the third is, I am seeing Andy Caro twice this week, which Natalie will know the answer to one of them right off the bat, but that's okay.
I'm going to say the Groundhog Day one, that you've never seen it all the way through. Because here's why. I think it's a cop-out if the second one is wrong because you only saw him like 2 times or you saw him 4 times. That's a cheat.
Well, Ariana, you know me so well and you know how much I hate This Is Us, so obviously I'm a cheater.
I think the second one as well, and I think that you've met him twice. Well, I've seen 2 photos, so if it's the third time, it's a secret, magical secret time. Or maybe it's more than that. I don't know.
The movie one is the lie. I have seen the movie straight through.
Yay! You're not a cheater, Brittany.
I'm not a cheater. The fun fact about that last one is I only just saw the movie straight through like 2 months ago. Before that, I've only ever like caught it on TV or I've like just seen like the end or I've seen like a bit in the middle and I'm like, I don't want to sit through this. But I finally watched the movie and I think it was in like November. I watched the movie straight through from like beginning to end. And I think I'm glad I hadn't done that while I was obsessed with Groundhog Day and seeing it, you know, once a week or twice a week for a while, because I think it would have distracted me from falling for the beauty that was Groundhog Day on Broadway.
Which, I definitely agree. I had seen it when we saw the musical. And
yeah, this is all Natalie's fault, by the way. So just
there's definitely a bit of a... a sense of trying to take it seriously. And not that the movie is also kind of like not that unserious. Like it is a comedy, but without the sense of undoing the conception, you know, the preconception, then yeah, I can understand how you get fall deeper into like how enriching it is about the world and stuff like that. And I did get there, but I had seen the movie, so at first I was like, oh, how's, you know, I was sort of undoing that in my head. But yeah, it's okay. The Rita was in the musical is a lot more interesting to me than the Phil,
Andy,
than the lead character.
Andy McDowell who plays her?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah.
I just feel like she's not a very interesting actress.
Well, again, let's tie this back to Hugh Grant. Four Weddings and a Funeral. Why? Why was he so obsessed with her? I hated her character in that. So I don't know. Sorry, Andy McDowell. I do not
If you're listening to this, we're sorry we don't like your acting.
Sorry. We're just not that into it. But yeah. I feel like she'd be a better villain. Like, I just don't like her as a, like, a romantic lead, if you know what I mean. Like, I feel like she'd be a bitch kind of thing.
Who's that girl from, like, Maid of Honor and the Mission Impossible?
Catherine Heigl?
No. Like, she plays, like, Tom Cruise's wife in the Mission Impossible movies, and she was opposite Patrick Dempsey in Maid of Honor. I feel like she always plays the girlfriend.
Maid of Honor.
Maid of Honor.
No, I'm thinking of Police
I know who you're talking about.
What is her name? I'm looking it up now. I have to. It is... Oh, my goodness. Michelle Monaghan. She reminds me of Michelle Monaghan in that she's, like, so pretty, but just kind of like, she's like this blank slate that people can project other things onto, but she's just
dull. Liked her in Magic Mike XXL, so I really liked her in that, and that is the only thing that I think I've seen her in that I found her memorable in.
I didn't even know she was in that, and I saw that movie twice.
I didn't either.
Have you
definitely
seen,
saw that movie.
Have you seen Magic Mike XXL?
Yeah.
Oh, twice. Yeah.
She's the wine mom, the mother, like the house owner that sleeps with Joe Mantiello.
She totally slipped in there. I wouldn't have known it was her.
Yeah.
All right. Well, those are our Groundhog Day, truth than a lie. Also, Groundhog Day is this week, which is why I'm seeing Andy Carl twice, because they're having a reunion concert, and I'm also going to his own concert thing, so pretty pumped. So the final thing that we do on Not About the Weather is a question of the day where you can ask us anything, and we have quite a few questions.
Well, yeah,
but
I definitely
want
to do all of them.
No. I'm just not sure which one to do. I don't want to do the first one because I don't know that I know what I could even talk about because I don't get that.
Hyper-specific subgenre? Yeah. I kind of like that.
I have a couple, but all right. It could certainly be another day.
No, let's do it. So I'll let you guys go first and then maybe I'll catch on to what exactly it means. So at Nurse Brack asks, what is your favorite hyper-specific subgenre?
I love, like, I have a real weakness for chick lit novels specifically about women in a big city working in the publishing industry. Like,
that is definitely a subgenre.
You know what I mean, right? It's definitely a thing. It's like people, or like they're either in the media or public, like they're in a magazine, newspaper, or like I'll stretch it to like music or you know, Hollywood assistant industry. But that of like the so like someone working in arts entertainment in a chick-lit, usually very heterosexual, big city novel is like a weird guilty pleasure of mine. I also really like sports movies and not sports, but I feel like that's not even a subgenre. That's like just a genre. But yeah, the chick-lit one is the first one I would go to for sure.
My favorite, I think, is like young adult, but like actually adult now, not like 16, fantasy with heavy like romance. So like something like Vampire Diaries or Shadowhunters, but like with a lot less fighting and saving the world and more about people like sitting around talking about their feelings and brooding. That's probably my favorite.
I have another one as well, because I actually just saw a play that this was really relevant to. I love historical fiction written in a contemporary time where people have tapped into the human story of a historical figure that's not particularly well known, or an aspect of them that's not particularly well known, which then makes me go on to have like emotional feelings about this historical figure. I just saw a play about Charles Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle that was like this, that was like about, you know, had a lot to do with, you know, him as a very young man on, you know, discovering the theory of evolution and the social impact, like him struggling with the social impact, the social crisis that he knew his discoveries was going to cause because he was religious, and like, you know, almost deciding to like throw away his notes and all of that kind of stuff. So I really like humanizing stories about historical figures, usually told, you know, written very contemporarily by someone who, like Hamilton, like a weird nerd got all emo about the human stories they found when like digging into a, you know, the a biography of like an important figure. So I really like that. Like when a young person writes a story about a historical figure that ends up making me cry. So I like that too.
So the only thing that I can think of that this really applies to, because I like, I'm like still coming down from this like 2 month long high, is Hallmark Christmas movies, but specifically ones that are either A, there's a prince involved, or B, there's like a snowstorm that prevents the big city bigwig from leaving, and like they have to save the Christmas pageant specifically, either because the community center doesn't have funding or the church can't host it, or something burns down, and the joy of participating in all of these Christmas activities makes them a better person.
Yeah. Right. Anything about young royals, like contemporary young royal fiction, is a huge, huge one for me as well. So yes, please.
Have you seen Frozen Love?
Yeah.
Okay. I saw it, Brittany. I'm not kidding when I say I feel like it was one of the best movies I've seen all year. It was so delightful. And I immediately thought of you and I was like, oh, I hope Brittany has seen this.
Oh yeah. No, so Danya and I like wrote a like huge, well, it took us a long time to figure out how to write this post about just like Hallmark Christmas movies in general, because we watched so many and we kept getting lost in the details of them. And I'm like, no, I swear in this one, the diner owner is talking to a ghost who is played by this person. And she's like, no, the person's not actually dead in the one you're thinking of. You're thinking of this one where the angel comes down and tells them how to save Christmas. And I'm like, oh, you're absolutely right. Like, they're just so good.
I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah.
I want to see all these movies.
Oh my god! No,
we don't get a lot of access to like Hallmark. I love that kind of level of like, you know, of movie, of romance movie, and we don't get that much access to them here. So like, are they on Netflix? Like,
where can I watch not Hallmark movie ones on Netflix, but there are a couple of really good ones on Netflix.
Where can I watch Hallmark movies online? Because I don't know.
Natalie,
have
you seen The Christmas Prince on Netflix?
No, because I was banned from watching it all Christmas. But why? I am going to watch it. Well, no, I just didn't get the time. It was not something Leo wanted to partake of. But I saw several people live blogging it, and I'm very interested.
It's really ridiculous. It's
so
ridiculous.
I love all movies about I'm secretly a prince or anything like that. Like, I love it. So I definitely want to watch it.
This one, though, soon. The Frozen one, it's just, it's so good.
I loved it because I'm always expecting when I watch a Hallmark movie for it to be ridiculous, but I felt like this one wasn't.
No.
I felt like it could have been a rom-com, like, in a movie theater.
Yeah, there's another one with, like, a bookshop owner where she, like, hits a guy, like, with a bike, and he, like, has amnesia, and he, like, has keys to an apartment, but it's actually not his apartment, and he, like, takes on this whole new identity and, like, falls in love with Christmas, even though he's, like, this crotchety guy who, like, hates Christmas and, like, doesn't know who he is because his wallet goes down a drain in such a dramatic fashion. Oh, my God, it's so good.
I don't know. I would like to watch all of these movies. Jared Padalecki was once in a Christmas movie. I don't know if it was Hallmark grade or better, but he was in like a festive Christmas drama movie. I don't know.
Do you like Rachel Lee Cook, Natalie? I can't remember.
I feel
like we had this conversation.
I can like her. I don't have any beef with her. Sure, why not?
I thought I had a conversation with somebody on Rewatchable about She's All That. Mm. Anyway, she's in the Frozen Love movie. Yeah. She's the bookstore owner.
Oh, good.
It's my mom was watching it and she goes, "This is such a like feminist movie. Everyone is so mature."
I would watch this movie. Where can I watch this movie? I don't understand. It says it's going to be on Tuesday, February 20th, 4 p.m. on the Hallmark Channel. I don't have the Hallmark Channel, so that doesn't help me.
Oh, well, I'm marking my calendar. So, okay. Yeah. So, hyper, super specific subgenres aside, we have one final piece of our Not About the Weather puzzle to end on. And we like to end every episode with a haiku. And I'm going to have Adriana read this because she wrote it and it's really sad and depressing for me. So take it away.
Once upon a time, there was a Dirk and he went gently into night.
Oh. Oh, bye, no. Dirk.
So, until we meet again here on Not About the Weather to complain and also be semi-excited about things in our lives, I will leave you as the host. It was a great hosting experience, as always. So, adios. Bye, Nat. Bye, Adriana.
Bye.